Read Smart, the Baillie Gifford Prize for Nonfiction podcast. This podcast is generously supported by the Blavatnik Family Foundation.
Hello, I'm Razia Iqbal. Welcome to Read Smart, the official podcast of the Baillie Gifford Prize for Nonfiction. This is a podcast where we bring together eminent critics, our prize judges, and leading nonfiction authors to talk about their work and the ways in which it reverberates in the wider world. If you enjoy what you hear, do please like us on your podcast app, share us, or take a moment to write a review. As always, we're immensely grateful to the Blavatnik Family Foundation for its generous sponsorship, which makes this podcast possible. On today's episode, we'll be exploring the complex political, historical, and cultural impact China has made on the world. I'm delighted to be joined by two leading experts. Isabel Hilton is founder of China Dialogue and contributing editor at Prospect Magazine. She's also the chair of this year's judging panel. We're also pleased to be joined by The Guardian's foreign leader writer and former China correspondent, Tanya Branigan, who was shortlisted for the prize last year with her extraordinary book about the Cultural Revolution and its legacy, Red Memory. Thank you both for joining us today. Let's start by looking at a very sort of general question about the way in which China has seen both its place in the world and the rest of the world. Isabel, let's start with you. It's a huge, huge question. But if we look at it from, say, 1949 onwards, how has China seen the rest of the world and its place in it?
Well, that is still quite a large question, Razia, but I'll do my best. I think historically, it's important to remember that China was always the biggest thing in its region. It was always the biggest thing in its own world. And, you know, much is made of the fact that the name Zhongguo means Middle Kingdom, and it means, you know, as it were, philosophically, the center of its universe. And China's political philosophy was very influential in the region. It was a big empire and expected the peripheral countries to come and pay tribute, although that was also a sort of way of cementing diplomatic alliances with smaller states. It was also quite often invaded. I mean, it was invaded notably by the Mongols in the 14th century and then by the Manchu in the 17th century. They both created much bigger global empires, remnants of which the inheritor state tried to retain. And particularly in the case of the Manchu, China today is twice the size it was in the Ming Dynasty, which was the last Han Chinese dynasty, because it retained the territories which were conquered by the invading Manchu. Now, since 1949, of course, the story that the party tells now is that China was great until insurgent Western powers, imperial powers, brought it down. And the party, the Chinese Communist Party, which took over in 1949 at the end of the Civil War, has made China great again, to put it no more subtly than that. Now, there is some truth to this. Certainly, China was weak, and at a time when Western powers were much stronger, they did exploit China. But China was already weak. It was declining. It was already probably at a moment when sooner or later there would have been a change of dynasty. But at that point, you know, we had the Industrial Revolution and the products of the Industrial Revolution and Western imperialism. And that was a tremendous blow, I think, to Chinese morale. The biggest blow, actually, was losing to Japan in the First Sino-Japanese War in the 1890s. And that's when the word humiliation first enters the discourse. It's much exploited now. The party talks of the humiliation of China and the need to restore it to what it sees as its rightful place in the world. Since China's latest Industrial Revolution, which has made it the second largest economy, it's had the means to try to create a new role for itself in the world. And that's the work in progress now.
Tani, when you were reporting from inside China, to what extent were you aware that there was this kind of tussle, if you like, between the kind of ancient civilization idea of China, but also trying to come to terms with the humiliation and looking forward to the new China.
Yes, I mean, China is a place that has just been through such a series of traumas. First of all, with that sort of disintegration and imperialist aggression, fighting that off from outside, but then obviously with its own internal issues with the Civil War, certainly with the Cultural Revolution, and before that, the Great Famine. So this sort of series of traumas that people have been through, and these profound changes brought about as well by the turn towards the market, which again had these wrenching effects. And so it often seemed as if people were really trying to reconcile these things in their mind. As Isabel said, the parties put this huge effort into constructing this narrative, firstly of 5,000 years of sort of grand civilization, the great sweep of Chinese history, only interrupted by these foreign powers coming along to ruin it all, and then of the Communist Party sort of restoring China to this greatness. And that's been very, very powerful in many ways. I think what's interesting looking at the evolution is that when I arrived in 2008, it felt very much as if people still saw this kind of David and Goliath situation. China was obviously becoming so powerful economically and diplomatically, and to people outside, it was starting to seem like a Goliath. But people inside China still seemed very much to think of it as being David. You know, we're fighting back against these great bullies. I think that's really shifted over the last 10 years or so. It was striking when Xi Jinping came to power and he used this quote from Napoleon, where Napoleon had spoken about China as being a sleeping lion. And Xi Jinping said, well, you know, the lion's waking up, but it's a peaceful and, you know, very amiable lion who's sort of seeking to do well in the world. So I think there has been this much greater confidence that we've seen, certainly coming from the party state and its messaging, you know, the kind of quite aggressive foreign diplomacy we saw in recent years, what was known as wolf warrior diplomacy. But at the same time, still, and perhaps increasingly in recent years, this profound fear of the outside world and what it can do to China, which is a message we've really seen ramped up recently.
I wonder if I can get both of you to reflect on the things that the West gets wrong about China. Certainly since the opening of China economically, which started with Deng Xiaoping and of course has been put in place with real vigor under Xi Jinping, there was an assumption in the West that somehow political freedom would follow the new economic freedom. And that seems to be at the heart of the kinds of beginnings of the things that the West gets wrong about China. Isabel, let's go with you first.
Yeah, I have mixed feelings about that. I mean, it does now look like a serious misperception. But I have to say, you know, I first went to China during the Cultural Revolution under Mao. It was extraordinarily oppressive. It was extremely poor. And the ideological range of permitted thought was vanishingly narrow. But if you fast forward, for example, to 2006, when I set up China Dialogue, it was an entirely different place, where there was a huge amount of open discussion about all kinds of things, including political transitions and political reform. And there was a tremendous expectation in China, among Chinese intellectuals, that that was the necessary and logical next step. So it wasn't a Western illusion. It wasn't something that the West sought to impose on China. It was also a very, very active discussion in China, and in some ways still is, although you don't see it now because it's, oh, you know, it's not something that is in favor with the party. But Xi Jinping's accession to power set us on a very different path. And it was different in many ways. You know, when I was first in China, the past, you know, China's history was kind of, in Marxist terms, if you like, the enemy. We had to take part in a criticism campaign of Confucius, which was, you know, pretty strange. And now Confucius is celebrated as, you know, tremendous, you know, pioneer of statecraft of global importance. So the other thing that one should remember about China is that the party story changes all the time. That, you know, they talk about eternal verities and, you know, China's, you know, magnificent exceptionalism. And China is an exceptional and interesting and place with deep historical roots. But the party's version of this, as I say, changes all the time. So one should always take the new version with a little bit of skepticism and ask, why has this changed and what are we being told now?
Well, I was just going to say, it's the old Soviet joke, isn't it? That the future's clear and it's the past that's uncertain.
Unpredictable, yes.
Exactly. It's sort of constantly being rewritten because it's really not there as a record, but as a tool or even a weapon in political battles. Yeah, I think it's really important, as Isabel says, not to write off the possibilities that have existed for change. It's certainly true that there was, at best, a lot of idealism or wishful thinking in the West, this idea that economic progress would magically bring about a sort of political liberal transformation. And I think there was also, frankly, a degree of cynicism, which is often overlooked, which was, for people in the West, it was just very convenient. People who wanted to do business, governments, companies, it was very handy to say, oh, it's all going to get better. Of course we need to engage. Of course, you know, well, we might not be prodding them very much on the difficult issues like human rights at the moment, but let's build up these relationships and do business together, and then we can get to the tricky stuff. You know, all of that was really very handy. So I think there's a sort of certain disingenuity sometimes with politicians saying, oh, perhaps we got it a bit wrong on China, because there were certainly plenty of warnings from out within China as well as from outside. But, you know, as Isabel said, it didn't have to be that way. And if you think back to sort of some of the turning points in recent Chinese history, we tend to think about 1989 and the brutal crackdown on the protests, which began in Tiananmen Square, as being almost inevitable. And I think in some ways they were. But you have to remember that, you know, millions of people right across China took to the streets. There was a real appetite and desire for change, a real hope, a real sense of idealism about what was possible, which might not have meant a transition to Western democracy, but certainly about greater freedom and greater liberty. And then even in the wake of that, as Isabel says, the kind of way that people managed to scratch out these spaces for civil society, for grassroots initiative, incredibly impressive and courageous and persistent. And there's no doubt that the appetite was there. I think the turn for me perhaps came a little bit earlier. I think the Arab Spring in particular was a real shock to the leadership. And that was one of the things that created this turn towards repression. But certainly Xi Jinping has embraced that and doubled down on it, there's no doubt, and taken it further than really anybody anticipated.
Tanya, I want to stay with you because Isabel was talking about the first time she went to China was during the Cultural Revolution, and your book, Red Memory, explores the trauma relating to the Cultural Revolution. I mean, how difficult was that book to write in terms of trying to get people to speak about both intergenerational trauma, but also just getting people to trust you to speak about that period of history?
It was actually really important for me that these were all people who had in some way already chosen to memorialize the Cultural Revolution. That was what was striking and what was interesting to me, that in a place where so many had forgotten and where the party state was mostly very keen that people should forget these 10 years of absolute devastation, you know, the sort of 2 million people killed, tens of million people hounded. Despite all of that, and despite the increasing sensitivity of the subject, there were these people who were determined to remember it, whether that be because they were horrified by what had happened, whether that be because they were still unrepentant, or indeed neo-Maoists who saw kind of value in that time and wanted to return to that. it was, or whether they were simply people who had been young and saw a kind of value and meaning in that era, that there was this appetite to talk about it and remember. And so all the people I spoke to were people who'd chosen to keep that memory alive. But certainly there was caution about speaking, particularly to an outsider. Some of those I approached didn't want to speak to me, and that's a really important part of the story, I think. There were some people who simply said no. And I think it would be vastly more difficult, if not impossible, to write the book now because it's such a different climate. There was this flowering of memory, and it feels as if that's really been crushed or certainly suppressed.
Isabel, in your experience of writing about China in the current moment, I mean, a lot of the focus of your work has been to look at the impact of a rising China and the way in which it is emphasizing climate change and the country's global environmental footprint. I mean, how easy has that been to write about?
Well, again, that's changed rather in very recent times. But when it started in 2006, it was a really very good moment. At the time, China was in the middle of a serious environmental crisis, which, you know, awful air pollution, terrible water pollution, and soil pollution that was banned but was still a state secret, so rather hard to discover. But the civil society flowering that Tanya mentioned was well underway. And quite a lot of it actually involved journalists who would organize trips to parts of China where, for example, dams were being built and then come back to the capital and report. And there was a quite a powerful community in Beijing, which included officials from what was then the Environmental Protection Agency and journalists and a particularly at the time progressive vice minister, who were trying to turn around the thinking that was, in official terms, a grow now, clean up later. So it was essentially all about growing GDP, making people better off, and the sense that environment was something that only rich countries could really afford to think about. And what the civil society activists, the journalists, and the enlightened officials were saying was China doesn't have the headroom to do this. You will have a catastrophe. We will have a catastrophe if we don't. Now, so when foreigners come along and are, you know, as we did, saying, you know, we're really interested in this. Can you, you know, tell us what's happening? Tell us how you see it. They were very, very open to it. So the model that essentially with China Dialogue was, you know, we helped Chinese writers and activists and thinkers and indeed vice ministers to write about the problem that China had as they saw it. We published into China experience from elsewhere, which we felt would be helpful. So we tried to avoid that kind of telling China what to do problem, which, you know, nobody particularly likes that. And it worked extremely well. We had a lot of support and a lot of enthusiasm, and it grew tremendously. However, that was when environment and climate were relatively safe spaces politically in China. And unfortunately, even that is no longer true. The degree of xenophobia that has arisen in China in the last 4 or 5 years is such that a foreigner saying almost anything or doing almost anything can be subject to attack from ultra-nationalists. It's a bit like Trump's America, but in China, it's that sort of section of opinion. So it's become more difficult. And we have seen people who are doing very good work being accused of either collaborating with foreign agents or simply being anti-Chinese for pointing out that China should change policy in certain areas, you know, and that's made discussion quite difficult. And that's one of the very negative results of the kind of militant nationalism which has grown up under Xi Jinping with official encouragement.
I wonder if I can get both of you to reflect on the way in which China has navigated its place on the international stage, that there has been this kind of real momentum behind how it conducts itself diplomatically, not least inside the United Nations, where you could see over years the UN being so willing to criticize China, and now China sits on the Human Rights Council inside the UN, and that has been this phenomenal shift in terms of how, by stealth, Beijing has made itself relevant with a really powerful voice diplomatically. Tanya?
Yes, certainly. There's been a very concerted campaign on the part of China to insert itself into international institutions, notably the UN, but also elsewhere, with very sort of protracted lobbying. And in a sense, it's absolutely right, of course, that a lot of the international multilateral institutions have been very dominated by the global north and have not reflected the views either of powerful players elsewhere often, or more generally of the sort of the poorer or less developed parts of the world. And so it's been very, that attempt to sort of address the westernization sort of obviously has a degree of sympathy, but also, of course, from China's long-term partners rather than allies, there's been sympathy there too. Clearly, you see that in the relationship between China and Russia, but also other players. But I do also think if you want to think about the growth of Chinese influence, you really just have to look to the story of the West and the election of Trump, but also even before that, the 2008 financial crisis was a clear point where we saw within the West, as well as in China, the rhetoric about China saving the world with this extraordinary $4 trillion stimulus package. So I think much of what has happened has also been about the failures of the West, whether they be failures of the system, as with the financial crisis, or more generally of morality, of leadership. And then certainly once you get to the Trump era, and indeed, you could look to the UK and Brexit and lots of other things, this sense of the West being in decline fundamentally, but also rather erratic, unable to lead, and fundamentally not a dependable partner anymore.
Isabel? China has a mission, and the UN is part of that mission. And the mission, as Tanya said, is to change the way the world works without destroying the institutions. I don't think that Russia cares about preserving the institutions, but China is embedded in the world and wants those institutions, but it wants them to follow China's rules and not the rules that have been followed, as it were, to date. Amongst those rules, for example, China now tends to talk about universal human rights with brackets, with air quotes around the universal, so-called universal human rights. Well, hang on a minute. That's a fundamental principle of the United Nations to which China has long signed up, but no longer. Now China is arguing that the rights of states should predominate. So it's really not up to anyone else to criticize what happens inside another sovereign state. China also purports to uphold the absolute right of territorial integrity and national sovereignty, but continues to give diplomatic cover and material support to Russia in its invasion of Ukraine. So, you know, if you sort of stand back and look at what China's doing, it is a long march through the institutions, which has been, you know, quietly and rather well executed, where China is using its considerable economic heft, the fact that it is the biggest trading partner of much of the General Assembly, so that votes in the General Assembly that criticize China are absolutely not guaranteed any longer. Its position as a permanent five member, that also means it can veto, and it's much more active now in using its veto in defense of its interests. And what China is explicitly trying to do, and has published, you know, a body of work on this, is to change the way we see the world from what it describes, as Tanya says, as a Western-dominated perspective, to what China calls a more democratic world in which a wider range of countries have a bigger voice. And China has appointed itself rather the kind of loudest voice of that group. So, you know, China still, whilst using this considerable power, likes to present itself as just another emerging country, but one that's been rather successful, but still representing the perspective of the South, of the emerging economies.
In the context of everything that both of you have said about how China is maneuvering itself in diplomatic terms, we have been completely compelled by Russia's invasion of Ukraine in the last 2 years and now the kind of potential for regional conflagration in the Middle East. But of course, in the back of everyone's mind is the possibility of or the real threat of engagement militarily between the United States and China over Taiwan. I mean, I wonder to what extent you feel that on the one hand, while Xi Jinping says that it is his ambition to ensure that Taiwan becomes part of China eventually, whether that means that it is inevitable that there will be conflict between the two big economic powers. Tanya?
Well, I think certainly Ukraine has clearly sharpened minds in Taiwan and created just a level of awareness of how pressing that situation is in a way that perhaps nobody anticipated. And I imagine that it's also sharpened minds in Beijing, in a sense that China has very clearly been looking at the world's response to that and thinking that through. I think it's clear that one of the big problems for China is that it aspired to peaceful reunification. And it was never very clear how that was going to happen, because while people in Taiwan certainly appreciated closer links to China, to the mainland, sort of economically and so forth, they didn't want to unify with the mainland. You know, Taiwan's never been under the rule of the Communist Party. It's never been part of the People's Republic of China. It has an identity of its own, and an identity that's become stronger. And we've seen that in its political trajectory, but also particularly after the incredible protests in Hong Kong to try to maintain the autonomy there, and the absolute brutal sort of crushing of that, the very decisive crushing of that. There's just no prospect of a sort of one country, two systems settlement. Nobody believes that. So that is out of the window. And of course, that makes the prospect of a forceful unification much, much more potent. And it is an issue which for many people in China, including people who are critical of the Communist Party, it's an issue that people hold very dear to their hearts and see as being very fundamental, that Taiwan is a part of China. And at some point, there must be this kind of coming together.
Isabel, what do you make of the gap between what we hear in terms of the rhetoric that comes from Xi Jinping and the kind of, I suppose, the real fears in the West that this is the flashpoint that could lead to a really quite big military conflict?
Well, I think we can't ignore the possibility that this is the flashpoint, and we have to plan for it, because were it to happen, it would have such devastating consequences for everybody. We think we're a long way away from Taiwan, but actually, you know, a wider conflict in that part of the world would touch everybody. And the worst option going down the scale, of course, is that China chooses to launch a military attack on Taiwan. I've always felt that that was perhaps the least likely, because it's highly risky. The People's Liberation Army hasn't actually fought that kind of war ever. The last military engagement they had was against Vietnam in the 70s, and they didn't come out very well. And the disruption to the global economy would be huge. You know, it could swiftly involve the US allies of Japan, South Korea, maybe the Philippines and the United States. It's a catastrophe. So what are the other options for Xi Jinping? If you look at China's behavior externally in its own region, it's worth looking at the South China Sea, where China has managed to militarize the South China Sea whilst it promised it wouldn't, without triggering a response, because all of its actions are just below the threshold at which it would be worth any rival power taking military action. And it's been extremely successful. And Taiwan offers many options in that regard. You know, the Chinese have declared, Beijing has declared the Taiwan Straits an internal waterway, which means that they could close it, according to their own argument, whenever they liked. A huge amount of global traffic goes through that waterway. It can cut communications to Taiwan, the sort of data cables, which we've seen Chinese cutting data cables in the Baltic. So, you know, it wouldn't be so hard in Taiwan. And we've also seen a visit from a former president of Taiwan, a Kuomintang leader called Ma Ying-jeou, who has been to China very recently. And the important thing to remember about the Kuomintang, the Nationalist Party, was that they were the losers in the civil war and fled to Taiwan. Unlike the native Chinese Taiwanese parties, they do believe that Taiwan is part of China. So if China can discredit the DPP and, if you like, the more nationalist Taiwanese parties and somehow get the Kuomintang back into power, then they can start talking again. And finally, there are a series of provocations that China could do. For example, to seize one of the smaller islands. There's an island called Kinmen, which has played a part historically in this dispute. It's very close to the Chinese mainland. It's a small island. It's not Taipei. It's not anything that you know most people could find on a map. You could seize Kinmen without there being much of a reaction, in my view, certainly militarily. And it would be demoralizing. It would be a series of these provocations could affect, over time, could affect Taiwanese public opinion. So there are lots of options, none of them good, but I think we need to be aware of all of them.
Tanya, go ahead.
I was just going to say, and I think as Isabel says, the prospect of a sort of full-on outright military attack is clearly sort of would bring with it a huge amount of problems and dangers for China. But what we do see, I think, is increasing risks that something could happen, whether it be through increased military drills or whether it be through perhaps taking something like Kinmen, something where people think they are taking calibrated action, but something goes wrong or there's misjudgment on both sides and the situation spins out of control. That seems to me the much bigger risk.
There's one last thing that I think we should be aware of, which is that the Chinese military has been purged repeatedly and recently. The entire rocket force was purged. The Ministry of Defense has disappeared. And this continues. There's just been a reorganization of certain strategic intelligence parts. Something is going on in the Chinese military in preparation for something. And that's probably as certain as we can be. But it's very, very much worth watching. That and China's continued technological advance, much of which is dedicated to military superiority. So very much a situation to watch and not a reassuring one.
Let's end just by throwing forward a little bit, because we are speaking in an election year here in the United States, which is where I'm speaking to you from. And you know, we know what the rhetoric was when Trump was president. And in some ways, the Biden administration didn't really change its attitude to China. It was one of those things that felt was a continuation from Trump, if pretty much everything else was not. How do you see the way in which, the given what we've seen in the last 7 years or so, the United States might try and calibrate its relationship with Beijing? Isabel, why don't you have a go at that?
I think we're not likely to see this confrontation. I think this is a profound strategic confrontation, which isn't going to change. And the best we can hope for is that it's managed so that it doesn't become volatile and dangerous. And that, you know, depends on a serious effort on both sides. It's a little better now than it was 2 years ago. it is still quite dangerous, and we're still living in a world in which big power politics have returned in ways that pretty much change all interactions. I think that between the Democrats and the Republicans, there isn't a huge difference. As you say, Biden maintained the sanctions. I think there is very little space in American politics for not being tough on China. And so on that side, it's not going to change. And equally, on the Chinese side, you know, much of Xi Jinping's story to his own people is that the United States is trying to stop China resuming its rightful place as a global leader. So everything that happens internally can be blamed on the United States and is being.
Tanya?
I would very much agree with all of that. I would just say that I think the danger posed by another Trump administration is obviously both the erratic nature of his leadership and the fact that he is so transactional. And if you look at the kind of comments that he made previously as president, where he made it very clear that while he might sort of talk about, or his administration might talk about the Uyghurs and Xinjiang, or they might talk about some of the human rights concerns, or indeed they would sort of extend the hand of friendship to Taiwan in many ways, that they were always up for a deal. Basically, its relationship was very much contingent on trade deals and those things that would benefit Trump most politically at home. And so I think in that sense, that makes it harder to know where he would be and what he would do on certain things. And the other thing I'd say that I think that's really concerning is that while much of the turn against China has in fact been about China's own actions, particularly over the last 10 years, but even before that really, and the sense of cumulative frustration you've seen notably in the US and in Europe, but also actually within the region as well from other countries about China's actions, that there is also within America now what I would call a bit of yellow perilism, actually, a kind of xenophobia in places, and I think a sort of paranoia, which is already affecting Chinese people, the Chinese diaspora, the Asian community more broadly, and is incredibly alarming and damaging and linked, I think, pretty directly to the increase in anti-Asian hate crimes in the US, for example.
Shame to end on such a bleak note, but there we are. Tanya Branigan, Isabel Hilton, thank you both so much for taking the time to talk to us today. We'd once again like to thank the Blavatnik Family Foundation for its invaluable support for this podcast. Now, to find out more about the Bailey Gifford Prize, you can visit the website or follow us on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, YouTube, and TikTok at BG Prize. And if you enjoyed this podcast, do please let us know. Write a review. Tune in next time to hear more from the world of literary nonfiction. Bye-bye for now.
Read Smart, the Bailey Gifford Prize for Nonfiction podcast. This podcast is generously supported by the Blavatnik Family Foundation.